Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. My name is Matt Harrington. I am your host, and we are going to be talking all about ABA research. In this podcast, we break down one ABA research article per episode, taking out the key findings for you so that on your morning commute or on your way into work, you can become a better behavior analyst. Now, let's get to the show. Okay, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Matt. Let's hop right into the article for the day. Thiobodu and colleagues 2025, evaluating feedback, frequency, preference, and its relation to task performance. No, we are not in behavior analysis and practice. We are in the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis. We're back at it. As much as I say that JABA is not my favorite journal anymore, it still brings me back with some bangers. We talk a lot in ABA about giving performance feedback, right? In any OBM study, in any supervision conversation, in any training conversation, oftentimes it is, what is the precise way to give feedback in a way that behavior changes, right? What verbal behavior and arrangement of verbal behavior produces change in other behavior? But let's talk today about how much participants, or trainees rather, actually want the feedback that we're giving them. And I think that there's a couple ways to consider what wanting feedback means just as a supervisor. So there are those who find feedback aversive. There are those who in the past, at other roles, at other jobs, at maybe at other RBT positions, feedback was almost always associated with punishing contingencies, whether that be aversives come in the form of losing your job or getting strikes or things like that, or even more subtle things. For example, feedback that's delivered in a way to make somebody feel less than, perhaps highlighting a peer who may not be on the best terms with, and then putting themselves down. So regardless of what research tells us about the way that feedback should be delivered, what this article and the general argument here is that there's also something to consider about the way somebody else receives that feedback from their own perspective based on their own learning history. I'm sure as a behavior analyst yourself, there's probably been times when you've said that you're really good at taking and giving feedback. That was one of my classic lines in interviews, is like, what's the best thing about you as an employee? I take feedback really well because my job is to nonstop give feedback. That was one of the things I said in multiple interviews. And the reality was, every single time I received feedback, it stung a little. So was I good at taking feedback when my first initial reaction was one of annoyance, one of frustration, one of who are you to tell me how to do my job? That depends. In earlier times in my career, when I got feedback, I wouldn't change my behavior. So I'd be giving feedback, I'd get frustrated by it. I'd say, who are you to tell me what to do? They were my boss in this case. And then I would go about my way. Later in my career, I was able to still have those emotions, right? Maybe we'll get into ACT one of these months, maybe a little acceptance, noticing of an emotion and watching it flow away. But I still changed my behavior because I recognized the validity in that feedback. So I call this all out to point out two things when it comes to supervision that we haven't really talked about in this series. The first thing is that, one, supervision and feedback and the way feedback is given, while there are best practices that we're going over, at its core, feedback is going to be received differently based on somebody's learning history. And then secondly, just because you feel an emotion or you feel a covert behavior or a thought flash through your head doesn't mean that should change the way you react to feedback. It may be the fact that as the supervisor, you're working with the trainee on how to notice the emotions of frustration, but then move forward anyways, right? Then move to the correct behavior. And that involves a lot of values work, a lot of motivation, but maybe that's something you tackle with them one-on-one. This study specifically digs into feedback preference, session by session, using complex multi-step tasks that trainees had to learn from scratch. Essentially, it was a puzzle, right? So here's a bunch of hard things to do. They get proceedingly harder. At what point are you specifically asking for feedback? And then how does that change your behavior? Because if they're not asking for feedback, their behavior shouldn't change because they don't know how to do the task. If they're not getting any type of reinforcement or reinforcement contingency, then their behavior is not going to improve at the task And so they'll be stuck in the loop. So when you ask for feedback, what does that look like? And specifically, what does that look like as we go through the difficulties levels? Easy, hard. And then if you become fluent, you've been very good at the easy, does that mean that you no longer need help for the hard and et cetera, et cetera? So we're measuring how feedback and frequency preference changes over time. There were two novel tasks with step level complexity. So essentially it got harder as you go on. And the goal was to test how task difficulty affects how often people ask for feedback. However, the real interesting thing here that we'll get to in just a bit is not how task difficulty affected feedback, but how the frequency of feedback changed once mastery or fluency was acquired. Because if you think about it, the hard thing that you're doing does not stay hard, right? Because of the science of learning, the thing we do every day, right? You get better at reaching the end goal. A good example of this is like a juggling task, right? I learned how to juggle when I was younger, throwing the scarves up, they float down slowly. I needed a lot of help from somebody right next to me, right? Catch this, do this. I went slowly. I needed lots of prompts and visuals. And then as you get better, right? And now you're juggling balls, you don't need that help anymore, right? Your reliance on external prompts and stimuli decreases a ton, which means your need for feedback decreases as well. Once that need for feedback decreased, how much did the request for feedback decrease as well? Because if you're still giving feedback to somebody who did need your help, but now doesn't need your help, is your feedback still reinforcing? Well, is your feedback still getting them a result that they wouldn't have gotten in the first place? No, which means your feedback is probably annoying, probably aversive, thus not having any desired result. So we had 35 undergrad participants, gotta love it when they throw the undergrads in. I just know that these folks were offered like 10 points of extra credit in some gen psych class. There were two computerized tasks with 16 steps, some simple, some complex. After each step, regardless if they succeeded or did not succeed, the participants could request feedback, yes or no. Feedback phase followed a baseline phase with no feedback, and mastery was 100% accuracy for 3 sessions. Pretty straightforward. So what are the key findings? This is what I really liked about this article and how I think it becomes really applicable to our day-to-day behaviors in supervision. Unsurprisingly, as performance improved, feedback requests dropped. 86% of participants followed this trend. 80 CEUs, $10 a month, 3 to 5 new CEUs being added every single month. Straightforward, simple. That's CEU Streamline. I created the Netflix of CEUs with all of not only my old content, but 3 to 5 new hours of CEUs being added every single month. Right now, we're at 85 videos and climbing more and more with over 400 behavior analysts getting all the CEUs they could dream about for only $10 a month. So if you're interested, go ahead and go to behavioristbookclub.com and click the link that says Streamline Info, or check the link below this episode. I know that you will love it, and I guarantee you that you will get all the CEUs you need at finally an affordable price. So how does this relate to our normal everyday supervision sessions? Consider the fact that when you're training a behavior technician on a behavior plan, there are numerous different things to teach on. There are skill acquisition tasks. There are specific trials. There are pairing techniques. There are behavior reduction strategies. There are where the bathroom key is and where the wipes are locked up. There are all of these small things to train. And the person who is engaging in the behaviors that need to be taught something, they don't need to be taught everything. They need to be taught a certain few things each time. And so when you're giving feedback and you're giving that feedback on a specific task that you're trying to work with them on, you need to be very cognizant that task, if you're doing a good job of giving feedback, is going to get mastered. They're going to learn where the bathroom key is. They're going to learn the correct flow of DTT. They're going to learn how to run naturalistic trials. And once they learn how to run those things, you then have to shift to another thing. And now you're giving feedback on something that is totally different. So the key takeaway here is that you need to have many different things, and you need to have an understanding of the wide range of behaviors that your tech needs to be able to demonstrate to be a good tech for this client so that as soon as they're mastered in one thing, you can then switch your training to something else, right? Because if you're just giving feedback after the preference for feedback goes away, then that means there's a preference away from feedback, which means you're now providing an aversive stimulation. Now, here was the interesting findings on the mastery of tasks leading to lower feedback requests. So essentially, if you got less than 50% of the steps correct, there was a high feedback request. Over 90% of the people at that point wanted feedback. If you got 50 to 75% of the steps request, there was a dip in feedback to about 78%. So 50 to 74, about 3/4 of the people wanted feedback. Now, once you went a little bit higher, 75 to 100, once they mentally crossed that mind of, okay, I know what we're doing, there was a sharp drop. It was only 18% request for feedback at that point. Now, why is 75 to 100% important here? If you think about fidelity, which we're going to talk about later this week, that's typically what we call a successful fidelity for interventions. 80% is baseline. Now, it's not perfect. We'd like 100, but that's generally pretty good. So if you're with somebody and you're working to get them to 100, you need to be cognizant of the fact that without any other information, without any other motivational operations, without any other feedback, they don't really want to listen to you when they're at 80%. They feel like they've done enough. They don't need any more. And that should change the way you approach the conversation. The way you give feedback for while they're learning the process is probably very direct. This is what you need to do. Good job, you did it. This is what you need to do. Good job, you did it. Now, when you get to that higher percentages, now when there's less preference for your feedback, you need to change what your feedback looks like. Instead of just saying, here's the thing, go do it, now start talking about why this last 25% is important. Because they probably know why going from 0 to 75% fidelity was important, but now start talking about the more intricate principles of behavior analysis that we're dealing with here. Specifically, it's probably going to be intermittent reinforcement. This is probably the time to take a breath, take a step back from feedback, and instead start saying, all right, so we're doing really well. What I'm worried about now is if we don't get it 100%, we're going to introduce something called intermittent reinforcement. Now, the challenge here is that when we step into that intermittent reinforcement zone, that means sometimes we do it right, sometimes we don't. There's actually a lot of risk for the client to get hurt or X to happen or X to happen. And when that happens, we have to go through all of these steps to help get that person back on track. And so what we're doing here is we're explaining why, and we're giving a bigger why, a bigger motivation for that person to then listen to our feedback, respond correctly, and get to 100%. We're giving them the why before giving them the how. So overall implications. We found in this article that learners want frequent feedback early on, especially the low levels. Another significant thing that they found within this kind of thing, notably, this means that when it comes to behavioral skills training, we're saying, okay, we're giving instruction, then we're doing modeling, then we're doing role play, then we're doing feedback. Feedback might need to be much earlier on in the process, maybe during the modeling and role play. So instead of just modeling, now it's modeling plus feedback. Instead of just role play, it's role play plus feedback. The reason why is because the earlier we can get feedback in, the more we can accelerate the process to go from zero mastery to 25% to 50 up to 75 and 100. The more complex the task is, the more demand for feedback stays. So regardless of who you're training, the more steps in the process, the more you should be focusing on feedback and using adaptive feedback schedules, things that change as the person approaches and reaches mastery. Well, that is going to keep the feedback actually relevant for the learner. And the thing that I would say is that make sure when you go into a supervision session, there's more than just one thing that you're looking at, right? I've had supervision sessions where I just go straight to DTT and the whole focus is DTT. By the end of it, I'm like, hey, I got DTT. What do I do now? Go in with a little bit more of a plan, spend some time prepping, realize that there's a couple different things you could be working on, and then focus on the priority list, right? Number one, I need you to get DTT right. Number two, we're talking behavioral interventions. Number three, we're talking pairing, right? Or whatever that categorization is. Focus on that priority list and then knock it off one at a time, making sure your feedback is always relevant and always fresh. All right. I really like this article. This is a great one to dive deeper into the specifics of feedback and what that looks like. So I will see you in the next one when we talk a little bit more about some interesting supervision topics. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. I hope you learned something, and I hope you continue to learn something as you tune in Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays to the Behaviorist Book Club. If you liked this episode, consider leaving us a review, sharing it with a friend, and most importantly, using it in your clinical practice. There's no other reason why I do this than to make you a better behavior analyst and to make myself a better clinician. See you in the next one.